We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Thursday, May 9th, and a lot of news to cover this morning, including a kind of hilarious controversy on social media with our friends at the Babylon Bee that we will get to a little bit later in this segment. But first, the House Judiciary GOP yesterday referred Michael Cohen to the DOJ for prosecution, coming as he is preparing to testify in the hush money trial in New York City. And so the House Judiciary GOP and Representatives Jim Jordan and James Comer sent a letter to the Department of Justice referring Michael Cohen to the DOJ for prosecution, alleging that Cohen lied six times to Congress and is Alvin Bragg's star witness in President Trump's New York City trial. Speaker Mike Johnson reposted that letter on his ex social media with this. He said, quote, "This convicted liar is the individual that the Manhattan DA is relying on for his politically motivated election year prosecution of a major party nominee and former president," unquote. So this is interesting because a lot of people are saying, and I think rightly so, okay, this is another strongly worded letter. What is the House majority actually doing to stop the weaponization of government and so forth? And the short response to that is, you know, not a lot that they can do in terms of a state level prosecution. And that's why we have the separation of powers. But there are still other things that they could do in terms of oversight, legislation, funding. Congress holds the purse strings, all of those things. But here's why I think this is a little bit different than just your average strongly worded letter from a committee in Congress. This is essentially baiting the DOJ to prove their hypocrisy and to show a two-tiered justice system by saying, if we are referring Michael Cohen for prosecution because the allegation is that he lied six times to Congress and yet Alvin Bragg is going to use him as a star witness, not only does this provide an impeachable, and that's a different term in context of a criminal trial than it is the Article One impeachment proceedings, right? So it provides impeachable evidence for Michael Cohen's credibility that Trump's lawyers can actually use at trial. And so I think this was helpful from the House Judiciary Committee, Jim Jordan, James Comer, to provide to Trump's lawyers. And so what we mean by, and what lawyers mean by impeachable evidence for their credibility is that you can impeach a person's credibility or testimony on the stand by providing contrary evidence. So it's more of a term of art suggesting that you're undermining, basically, the credibility of testimony on the stand or impeaching the witness in that vein, which is obviously separate than the process of impeachment that generally we are used to referring to on the presidential or federal office holder level. So I think that this is, for those twofold reasons, this is interesting that this has come out just possibly days or maybe a week or so before Cohen's testimony, and it'll be interesting to see if Trump's lawyers actually use this for that purpose and ask him about his testimony, which to Congress, which if Michael Cohen as a witness has to respond to that, then he'll have to be probably very careful. And whether or not Biden's DOJ follows up on this, this is one of the reasons that I think conservatives generally, and any American that cares about the rule of law and justice being blind, would say that even if the Biden DOJ turns a blind eye to this and they have that standard of hypocrisy and two-tiered justice system that doesn't actually go after genuine criminal offenders, but it matters whether the defendant or the potential defendant has an R or a D after their name, then when a Republican gets back into office, then of course that's a potential to follow up. So that was just a really interesting development that I think it's very clear that the members of the House and Jordan and Comer are trying in within their purview to do what they can to at least show the lack of credibility that Cohen has. I mean, and think about this, that Alvin Bragg, not only is the indictment just utterly ridiculous on face, and it's and we've talked about this certainly on this show, and if you're following that at all, you already know, you know, that it's like this this allegation that depends on a non-crime, and it's sort of a convoluted way to attempt to get to these 34 felony counts. And Alvin Bragg is relying on Michael Cohen as his star witness, and then Stormy Daniels, who, as even CNN commentators said, she impeached herself in terms of credibility by saying on the stand that she hated Trump, and her testimony was totally irrelevant to what the DA supposedly is actually prosecuting. And it's very clear that the entire point of this sham is just to influence the court of public opinion. And I think National Review, in their article yesterday, was absolutely correct that the only point of this trial is that if there's even one conviction, that Joe Biden can use that and can refer to Donald Trump as a convicted felon for the rest of the campaign. And that's why this was pushed to trial, rushed to trial. And this was the first indictment that was handed down, even though legal experts across the board have agreed that this is very, very weak. So hopefully, you know, the Democrats' strategy here will backfire on them. And it usually does. And this coming as several Democrats have just been so hilariously stupid over this past week. And it's so funny because Governor Kathy Hochul out of New York claims to regret saying that black children don't know what computers are. Yeah, she actually said this during a comment when she was being interviewed at a business conference in California. And she actually said that she thinks that people in the Bronx and black people specifically don't know what a computer is. And obviously the Democrats are just trying to silence this story. But as the Salem Roundup this morning says, if she had an R next to her name, she would be lambasted as a racist. And I think that's absolutely true. And meanwhile, AOC, who is probably the most ridiculous Democrat in Congress, even though there is a race to the bottom there with all of the members of the squad. But she went on some kind of podcast and also suggested that not only bridges are racist, which we've heard that from Pete Buttigieg and other Democrats, you know, suggesting that infrastructure is racist. But she also suggested in this like minute and a half rant that you can go on End Wokeness, that X account, and you can listen to this full rant. But she actually suggested that commutes are racist, because commutes, if it takes from being in the Bronx, let's say, and I don't know why Democrats have such a problem with, you know, just one area of New York. But anyway, if it takes a long time to actually get to New York City and actually get to your place of business, or according to AOC, your community, the places of faith, and, you know, all of these things, then it's purposeful. It's an intent by, you know, the overarching bad, you know, white person, or this conglomerate of, you know, of racist infrastructure builders, that they want to purposefully try to incentivize specifically minorities just to be isolated. And so so your commute is racist. And I'm thinking I should get reparations because it's like a 10-hour flight to Paris from where I live. And, you know, I could be sipping on European fabulous espresso this morning, but I am left with my maple pecan Nespresso. And, you know, that is just, that's not incentivizing a good community for me and culture. So AOC, I think that really she needs to put forth a bill that, you know, provides reparations because I live so far from Paris and the commute. I mean, it's really tragic. All right. So turning to this other ridiculous controversy this morning, and I think we as a Christian network need to address satire because the Babylon Bee put out this absolutely epic video that was to advance the book that pastor and author Lucas Miles wrote that is called Woke Jesus. And the point of the book is to show how the left has been for a while tried to harness the person and the ministry of Jesus Christ, pervert that and suggest that Jesus was a socialist, he was a humanitarian, he was, you know, love is love, he would affirm all of the genders. I mean, all of these things that all of you have heard. And so in helping promote this book, which I can't wait to read because Lucas Miles, full disclosure, is a friend of mine and has been for years and is excellent, and this will be a great book. We'll get him on the show and interview him. But the Babylon Bee, in helping promote this, did this satirical piece that had an actor portraying Jesus in his earthly ministry and suggested satirically what this would have looked like if Jesus was, in fact, who the left says that he is. And I always think it's hilarious that the very same people who don't believe in God are absolutely convinced that they know what he said and what he wants for my life and how much I am a quote-unquote fake Christian, according to them, when they don't even believe in him. So they're holding me to a standard of a God that they don't believe in, which is utterly idiotic and ridiculous in and of itself. But this is part of the satirical clip, and you need to watch the whole thing. It's on the Babylon Bee's website. It's called Woke Jesus, but let's play this clip. This is cut 3.
If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn it off with the other also. Unless they're a Republican, then you can feel free to punch them in the face. Let the children come unto me, and do not hinder them, unless they might be born into poverty, or they might be an inconvenience to your party lifestyle. In that case, feel free to murder them in the womb. Haven't you read that in the beginning, God created them male and female, and genderqueer, femboy, trans man, trans woman, two-spirit. You have heard that it was said, hate your enemies. But I say to you, this is correct. And here's a handy little chart to help you understand who your enemy is, based on Marxist intersectionality theory.
As the Lord was setting out on a journey, a certain young man approached him.
Oh, my Lord, what must I do to be saved? Be less white.
But the man went away sad, for he was very white.
And it goes on. And that last part was absolutely my favorite, that the man went away sad, for he was very white. And I interviewed Seth Dillon last night on my Salem media show, Jenna Ellis Tonight. So you can go to anywhere that you stream and listen to that interview. We don't have time this morning to play that whole interview. But Seth talks about how the people who are the most upset about these types of satirical videos and the headlines are often the ones that are the most upset at the truth that is portrayed through satire. Now, this is not, in my view at all, blasphemous or, you know, in any way mocking the person of Jesus. It's mocking the leftists and the cultural Marxists who are suggesting that kind of thing, saying, You know, he made the male, female, and gender queer, and femboy, and all of these things are actually what Jesus said, which we know from the truth of the Bible is absolutely antithetical to what Jesus actually said. And so the video is perfect in that it shows how ridiculous it is to suggest that that is possibly what Jesus taught. So so you can go and listen to my interview with the Bee Chief, Seth Dillon, and on Salem Media, Jenna Ellis tonight. And then you can also go and listen to that full clip, which gets even funnier at the Babylon Bee. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And yesterday, Speaker Mike Johnson, along with several members of Congress and also others who are concerned about election integrity heading into the 2024 election, held a press conference on the House steps, the congressional steps, to introduce the SAVE Act, which is the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act that will protect federal elections by ensuring that only Americans get to decide American elections and that you should have to provide proof of citizenship before you vote. This seems very nonpartisan, very obvious, and a very clear common sense way to protect elections. So Cleta Mitchell, who is an attorney, a senior legal fellow at the Conservative Partnership Institute and the chair of the Election Integrity Network, was one of the members that joined Speaker Johnson yesterday, and she joins us now. So Cleta, good morning, and tell us more about the SAFE Act.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Jenna. This is something that I started realizing earlier this year, really in January, that I just started to realize, and maybe it's just God put this on my heart, to start thinking about the fact that we have a perfect storm of threat of illegals voting in the U.S. elections this year. And I think it's by design, because what we have is 31 years ago, when Congress passed the National Voter Registration Act, NVRA, and directed that every Department of Motor Vehicles, every DMV in the country, and every social services agency had to make voter registration part of their intake process. And so what I began to realize is that that was all done at a time when our immigration laws were not being completely disregarded. And so all of the safeguards that exist in federal law are built on a sort of assumption that the immigration laws are being enforced. So the Help America Vote Act, which is a federal law, it requires that states have to verify identity of voters before they can be added to the voter rolls to vote in a federal election. But they're just checking identity. They check driver's licenses, driver's license numbers, and they check the last four of the Social Security number. Well, guess what I realized? you don't have to be a citizen of the United States to get a driver's license. Every state issues driver's licenses to non-citizens, and 19 states issue driver's licenses to illegals. You don't have to be a citizen to get a Social Security number. And this administration is basically reclassifying illegals in massive numbers as seeking asylum or parolees. And I'm not an immigration expert. It's just a term that has to do with a different sort of exception to the immigration laws. And they're all getting Social Security numbers. So there is, and you add to the fact that 10 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that the federal postcard application, which the federal law requires every state to accept and use for voter registration, that states cannot require documentary proof of citizenship in order to register. So all the states are required by federal law to use this form. And the Supreme Court has said that until Congress changes it, the states cannot require someone to prove they're a citizen. They just have to accept their word that they're a citizen. And that is what the SAVE Act is doing. It is basically overturning that Supreme Court decision to say not only are states allowed to ask for documentary proof of citizenship, but they're required to, because there are a lot of states, as we know, blue states, that if given the option, they want to register non-citizens. They want to get those numbers for Democrats up. So this is a real threat. It's a real concern. And so that's what the SAVE Act would do, is to basically reverse that Supreme Court decision, allow states, require states to ask for documentary proof of citizenship when they use the federal postcard form. And it would also add a criminal penalty that anyone who knowingly registers a non-citizen to vote would be guilty of a federal crime. So that's what the legal part of all of this is.
And Cleta, this makes so much sense, and it seems like this should be a no-brainer. And why did Congress initially not include proof of citizenship in federal law? I mean, was this an oversight potentially by Republicans, or was this something that, you know, was kind of a long game for Democrats?
Well, first of all, remember, this was Bill Clinton's number one. It was H.R. 1. After Bill Clinton took office. It's very interesting. If you go back and look, this is a little bit of an aside, but it tells you, I have been saying this for many years. I used to be a Democrat. I was in the legislature in Oklahoma. I was a Democrat. So I really kind of understand, having been brought up in Democrat politics. For Democrats, political process is everything. They are constantly, they're the ones who are always changing the rules and the laws on elections and campaign finance and FOIA and, you know, lobbying and ethics, all of the political processes, that's their bailiwick. And it's been very frustrating to me as a conservative and talking to Republicans for the last 30 years to say, you got to pay attention to the political process. Bill Clinton gets elected. H.R. 1 that was passed was the NVRA. It was the first time, it was really an encroachment on the state's voter registration prerogative. Only with the Voting Rights Act and the requirement that states during the 60s to get rid of the vestiges of Jim Crow, which, by the way, let's not forget, Jim Crow was created and imposed for decades by Democrats. But the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and its progeny, that was the first real encroachment by the Congress on the states' rights to handle voter registration. Then this NVRA comes along, the motor voter. That's a big encroachment on the states. It had always been within the prerogatives of the states to determine the voter registration procedures and laws. So then, after the Voting Rights Act, they come in and they say, okay, all the DMVs, all the social services agencies have to do this. So the Republicans were not for this. They're still Republicans. I really hate the NVRA because of its encroachment, and it has a lot of really terrible provisions. But it is the law. But it wasn't something that the Republicans were thinking about at the time. They probably, if I go back and look, I would bet that many Republicans voted against the bill. But I don't think there was any thought about having to confirm citizenship. It was just a given. It's only been within the last few years. And now then what we have is this perfect storm with the Biden executive order ordering every federal agency to become a voter registration agency and give voter registration materials to everyone, including inmates in federal prisons. And we have documentation to show that. And so now what we have, and we have this complete disregard of the immigration laws, which is why the House impeached Secretary Mayorkas. First time in American history that a cabinet secretary has been impeached for failure to enforce the immigration laws. I just think that nobody dreamed that they would go this far as to want to have non-citizens, illegals even, voting in our elections, because the Democrats need to get their numbers up, because the American people are not buying what they're selling. So they need to get different kinds of voters. That's what they're doing. They're shopping for voters.
Yeah. And I mean, and even the polling is indicating that, you know, Biden's coalition is fading away and he's losing a lot of votes. And we can see, you know, that this is part of the reason that they're trying to go after President Trump, who's the presumptive GOP nominee, with a lot of this lawfare, including the New York case and all of these other campaign expenses to get him off of the campaign trail. I mean, the Democrats know that if the game is fair, they're not going to win, and they have to try to use the process to their advantage, because their message just doesn't resonate with regular conservative American voters, or even not just conservative Americans, people who are genuinely interested in advancing America as a nation. And so this is just common sense. And I'm speaking with Cleta Mitchell, who is a senior legal fellow for the Conservative Partnership Institute and the chair of the Election Integrity Network. So we have this Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or the SAVE Act, that's now been introduced. But as you mentioned, I mean, this is part of the Biden administration's agenda to bring in all of these, fly in all of these illegals that they've admitted to, bring in potentially all of these refugees from Gaza. I mean, and even Speaker Johnson, Cleta, has said, you know, even as of a few years ago in Congress, that this is the intent of the Democrats. So how much of a chance do we actually have that this SAVE Act will get through, maybe the House, as it should, since we at least have the majority there, but the Senate, and then not be vetoed by Biden?
Well, you know, that's the thing that we have to – the thing we have to – people need to understand that Tea Party Patriots Action conducted a polling in January of this year. When I first – I circulated a memo in January this year to say everybody needs to focus on this. This is a mayday, mayday. And so Tea Party Patriots Action commissioned a poll. Would you like to know that a supermajority of Democrats support the principle that only citizens should vote in U.S. elections? 83% of the American people favor the laws and principles that only citizens should vote in U.S. elections, and 87% support that you ought to be required to provide proof of citizenship to register to vote. So it's the people are for this. They are for this. And if we can just educate people and get people engaged and contacting their legislators, including Democrats, you know, that's the only way that we're going to be able to get this done. And if we can raise the awareness and make Joe Biden understand that massive numbers of Americans support this and are looking to him, if we can get this through Congress, and then it's sitting on his desk, and he's got to decide between massive numbers of everyday Americans versus his left-wing handlers, his socialist, communist, Marxist handlers, right before an election. I don't know. I think that that's something that people should, I think that they will think twice. But I want to encourage people, if you want to know more, we launched an Only Citizens Vote Coalition. It has over 70 organizations, including American Family Association, have signed on to support the principle. Go to the website. It's www.onlycitizensvotecoalition.com, and you can read the SAVE Act. You can see, there's a way to sign up. We are going to have toolkits where people can, you know, what are the things people can do? And I believe that this, if we can give Americans the way that they can get involved and talk to their local officials, look, I'm for people talking to their county commissioners and their city councils and their local election boards and talking to their DMVs and saying, what are you doing to make sure that you are not registering non-citizens? These are things that, as citizens, if we get engaged, I fully believe that we can reclaim this process from the left-wing socialist organizations that are bringing these illegals into communities all over the country. And I believe very strongly that they are giving them voter registration, getting them registered, because that's, I think, the Democrats' secret plan to win this year.
Wow. And I'm speaking with Cleta Mitchell, and the website is onlycitizensvotecoalition.com, onlycitizensvotecoalition.com. And I'm looking on this website, Cleta, and one of the highlighted items is that according to the Census Bureau, over 21.7 million potential non-citizen voters. I mean, that number is staggering. And if even a fraction of those potential non-citizen voters actually engage in voting in 2024, that has the potential to swing a lot of elections. I mean, we're not just talking about the presidential election or federal. I mean, this would include state elections as well, right?
Absolutely. It will include city council, county commission, state legislatures. I mean, the potential for this to completely wreck America as a constitutional republic is very real. I mean, how many illegals does it take to get into Utah's election to get them registered when Utah has all vote by mail? So there, and I don't care what anybody says, when you have voting by mail, I call that unsupervised voting. How many, you know, North Dakota does not have voter registration. How many illegals does it take to get into North Dakota to go vote? And we don't know until the next day, and suddenly North Dakota split from red to blue. In Arizona, because of this Supreme Court decision in 2013 that said Arizona could not require proof of citizenship to vote in the federal elections using that federal postcard, Arizona now has a two-tiered system. They have a federal-only registration list. And guess who's on the federal-only registration list? Those are the people that are allowed to vote who cannot prove that they're citizens. And there are more people registered on the federal-only list in Arizona than the margin between President Trump and Joe Biden in 2020. So if anybody thinks that this is all, the Democrats are all saying, oh, there's no problem. And they, you know, that's their excuse for voting no on this bill and on a bill yesterday. Yesterday, there was a bill on the House floor to say that only citizens, U.S. citizens, could be counted for purposes of apportioning Congress and deciding how many representatives there will be from each state. Every Democrat voted no on that bill.
Wow.
Every Democrat voted no.
They're undermining our constitutional republic. And Cleta, thank you so much for your work, for bringing this to our attention. We need to engage this issue. Call your members of Congress. Go to onlycitizensvotecoalition.com. Read the state legislators' open letter. Get resources. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Well, if you are concerned, as I am, at the erosion of our constitutional republic, the moral fabric of our culture, and you are wondering how liberal democracies become tyrannies, then you might want to read this new book, The Total State, How Liberal Democracies Become Tyrannies, by our good friend Orrin McIntyre at The Blaze. And this book is out today. So Orrin joins us now. So Orrin, talk to us about The Total State.
Yeah, I think, Jenna, like a lot of people, I was a talk radio conservative for most of my life. I grew up listening to Rush Limbaugh, and in civics class, I learned about how the Constitution and the Bill of Rights were going to protect us from tyranny. You know, they were going to protect us from these horrible governments that had shown up in the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany. And then when I saw what happened in 2020, like a lot of people, I said, you know, how is this possible? I live in a constitutional republic. I have the Constitution. I have the separation of powers. How is it that my churches are being shut down? What's going on here? And so what I did is I kind of went on an intellectual journey. I looked through a lot of different thinkers that were outside of the box, and I started to try to understand how power is actually working in the United States and why it seems like the government was able to accrue all this power, even though we were supposed to have popular sovereignty, this democratic check on the power of the state.
This is such an important topic because I think that everyone who is listening is aware of, you know, exactly all of these problems and specifically how, you know, the church needs to be more engaged in culture and in society so that we can ensure that our law and our tradition and our culture is founded on a moral premise. And that's what the left has constantly sought to undermine and to replace Christian theology as the main movement in and the main basis of morality in culture that then affects law, and replace that with cultural Marxism, with secular humanism, with relativism, and all of these other theories that suggest that we can reinvent our own reality according to our human worldview, and then ultimately we obviously get to immorality, because if America is only a social contract that can be reinvented at whim, then we are at the mercy of whatever the collective judgment of whoever is in power or can wield power would like to enforce in society. And so, you know, it's really easy to see how we get to tyranny when a few that are in power can reinvent America however they prefer. So what do we need to know in terms of, you know, the ideology that that you reference in The Total State, and even just being aware of this, where we go from here? Because I think a lot of people are suggesting that, okay, we just need to, you know, vote more and vote stronger and engage. And all of those things are very good, but we need to have solid Christians that we can vote for who won't get into public office and then cave to the whims of power and the left. And so, you know, my response has been over, especially the last few months, I'm increasingly more convinced, Oren, that the solution is biblical discipleship and to engage in the church and the family even more than we engage in civil government. It has to start there first, because if we don't make disciples of Christ, then once we get to the civil government realm, we're just left with, you know, what, like pro-capitalists and saying, you know, okay, great. I mean, that's really not getting us anywhere. But what do you think?
No, I think that's exactly right. I think that the problem is that in many ways we stopped worshiping God and we started worshiping America as some kind of economic system or some kind of abstract contract. Look, the founders knew what the Constitution was. It was an instantiation of their way of being, their folkways, their traditions, their faith in God, their communities. And they understood and told us explicitly the Constitution only worked if we maintained virtue, if we stayed a moral and religious people. And the fact that we went ahead and pretended that the Constitution would just work because it was some kind of well-balanced mechanical piece of political technology, rather than the living representation of who we are as a people, meant that we gave up our responsibility. The problem is that we have scaled up our civilization and abstracted our civilization into these vast bureaucratic organizations, instead of realizing that we're responsible for our communities. We're responsible for our homes, our families, our areas. We have to take an active role in them. And the only thing that ultimately restricts the power of government is not words on a piece of paper, but the actions, the virtuous actions of people who are engaged with the people around them, who care and support and maintain the community that they're a part of. And so I think a huge part of fixing this problem is making sure that we are prepared to take all over many of the duties that we have handed over to the total state: the education of our children, the care of our elderly parents, the care for our neighbor. These are things that we have in many ways, even often the church has handed over to the total state. And as long as they have that duty, they also have that power over us. and we need to change that.
Yeah, so well said. And, you know, without the moral fabric that builds and undergirds society, then we have what Justice Scalia used to always refer to, and of course, quoting others, as the Constitution is merely a parchment guarantee. At that point, because, as our founders rightfully said, our Constitution was made only for a moral and upright people. It's wholly inadequate to govern any other. And it's true that unless we, in the words of our first Supreme Court Chief Justice, John Jay, select and prefer Christians as our leaders, then our Constitution is merely that. It's a piece of parchment. And even though the rule of law should persist and it should restrict the power of a tyrannical government, it should limit and separate powers. The only true way to enforce that is to ensure that tyranny does not persist. But what we're seeing, Oren, I think even among some of the well-meaning, perhaps right, is that they just want a tyranny of the right. And so it's not even that, and so it's actually antithetical to a conservative premise and a true constitutional originalist position to say that instead of limiting and separating powers, which means that, hey, we don't win all the time, you know, we meaning whatever our cause or our group or, you know, whatever, our interests won't always win out because we're limited as well. It's that the rule of law is truly for everyone and everyone is under the same law. We're seeing kind of this combating the tyrannical left with the rise of a tyranny on the right that we just need to win and we just need to be in power so that we can then crush our enemies. And I think that that's actually helping tear down the Constitution with our own hands.
Well, I'll say this. I think that ultimately we have to be honest with ourselves about what the Constitution is. Again, as we've both said, the founders told us who the Constitution is for. And if we're acknowledging that we are not those people, then we need to understand that the application of it may not work. Order is what creates the ability to inculcate virtue. Virtue does not come from liberty in and of itself. We can only practice our liberty if we are virtuous, which again is something the founders were incredibly clear about. And if we're in a situation where the left is actively denying the ability to be virtuous, if it's trying to dismantle virtue at every opportunity, then winning might be an essential aspect of putting ourselves in a place where we can create the order to once again become a virtuous people. I understand the worry of, you know, the swing back of the pendulum, but we have to be honest with ourselves. We have to look at the world around us. If the left don't fear the right, if they don't fear a pushback, if they don't think the mutually assured destruction strategy doesn't work, if Ronald Reagan says, but we'll never fire back, don't worry, we'll never actually use this. But that's what the right has done to the left. The left says, we will take all the power and we will use it and we will crush you. And the right says, well, don't worry, we'll never punish you for it. And I don't understand how that's ever supposed to work. Even in Federalist 51, power only checks power. Ambition only checks ambition, as Madison said, if you actually have it, if you're actually willing to use it. And so I think it's important for us to realize that, yes, we should still govern well. We should still treat people well. But we cannot be scared of power and we cannot be scared of putting the left in their place because they are doing that to us and they are not stopping and they will not stop until it hurts.
Well, absolutely. And I think that this is the exact framework that has made Governor DeSantis in Florida so successful, is that he's using every power and tool available to him in order to crush his opponents and to restore order and virtue and protections for the people of the state of Florida, where both you and I live. And we're very happy with our governor here in Florida. Uh-huh. And that's great. And so power is a good thing. When wielded correctly. And so what I'm talking about are the people who just want to attain power and outside the bounds and restrictions of, you know, the good rule of law, just say, well, we just want to crush our enemies. Like, for example, the people who are saying, you know, oh, censorship bad, but then they're going and applauding when, you know, Elon Musk's ex cancels or suspends somebody that they don't like on X. And so they want the rule of law to apply just to their friends, but then they're perfectly happy to go outside the bounds of the law when they crush their enemies. And that's not trying to use power effectively to then restore order. That's just wanting to be the one in power to then, you know, go and crush their enemy. So I think that the goal is really important. And certainly, I think you're absolutely right, Orrin McIntyre, that conservatives and especially Republicans should not be afraid of power. We shouldn't just see these, you know, very strongly worded letters and these sort of empty threats, because, you know, once you know that this, it's just crying wolf, then nobody's paying attention. Certainly the left isn't. And so we have to combat with teeth and with tools and, you know, with the arsenal of power weapons that we have at our disposal. And I wish that Republicans understood that as well as Governor DeSantis. And, you know, one of the big reasons that I supported him in the primary is because as much good as President Trump did in his first term, and he did a lot of good, there were other ways that he was, frankly, taken advantage of or just missed opportunities or didn't do the right thing because, one, he's, you know, not genuinely a conservative. We all know that. But second, he just didn't understand some of the tools at his disposal and so was manipulated by others who had goals and had an agenda that was different from the conservative constitutional proposition, where somebody like a DeSantis, who actually reads everything, is a lawyer himself and understands all of this, wouldn't be as easily manipulated. And he could instead himself use the powers at his disposal for good and to restore order. And, you know, and I'm hopeful that Trump has learned, you know, kind of his lesson. And if he ends up in the White House in 2024, that he won't make some of those same mistakes. And I am, you know, praying for this country, because I think we are on the brink of, as your book is the title, the total state. And so just in the last few minutes we have here, I mean, you know, barring getting good people in office and all of that, what are some of the practical ways that you argue that, you know, individuals can understand how to combat the liberalism and the progressive leftism that they see even in their local communities and also, you know, upwards into the federal level?
Yeah, one of the big focuses of the book is that the problem is not just ideological. Obviously, they do engage in Marxism and these things, and that matters. But ultimately, the problem is actually one of structure. We have scaled our society into these massive bureaucracies, and this abstraction is bad for our society. Our founders understood, by implementing a federal system, that government is best done close to home, that you have to care about the people, you have to know the people, you have to engage with the people. They can't just be figures on a spreadsheet. And so if we as individuals want a better government, we need to be engaged in taking care of our communities, making sure that we are strengthening them, and most importantly, pulling the power of government as much as possible into localities, into states. The actions of governors like DeSantis and Abbott to go ahead and tell the federal government, sorry, we're not enforcing this thing because it's wrong and we don't care what you say, go pound sand. That is a good start, and we need more of it. We have to see this. We have to install vigorous executives who are willing to stand up to the federal government and tell them no matter what their threats are. We have to engage in local governments that are willing to pull that power away from the federal government, you know, resist the pull of funds, resist the pull of all these other things, and instead focus themselves on growing and protecting their community. Because when, you know, Congress passes an unconstitutional law, it's your sheriff that tells them, sorry, no, I'm not coming to collect the guns. You know, when you have these kinds of things where the governor can stand between you and a corrupt federal system, that is a key aspect of stopping the total state. And so I think focusing on that locality, focusing on that state level, and not just in the old build up your community sense, though that's critical, but understanding in a very power politic way that you need to start reasserting states' rights and local rights and community rights if you're going to stop the total state. I think that's critical.
Yeah, so well said. And, you know, a lot of people refer to this as kind of as the doctrine of the lesser magistrate. And, you know, while there is a book by that same title that, you know, I've read, and I don't agree with all of the propositions in the book, and that's kind of an argument for another day. The overarching premise of returning to federalism and a local government and state government actually being more powerful to protect the rights of the people more than the federal government, and to repel the overreach of the federal government into states, is exactly what every governor needs to be doing. And I think that's where, you know, the Florida blueprint is the right way. And so, you know, whatever anyone's views of Governor DeSantis is, you know, he has the blueprint for how to return to states' rights and to kind of get rid of this whole, you know, massive federal overreach, as well as the Convention of States Project, which you all know I support. And you can go to conventionofstates.com and learn more about that. But Orrin McIntyre, the book is The Total State. You can buy that as of today. And you can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.